What's up? It's Delaney, and I'd love to invite you to become an honorary co-host of the Self-Helpless podcast. Do you want to pick episode topics and guests? Done. Want to surprise your loved ones with shout-outs on the show for a birthday, project launch, a much-needed divorce? Whatever you're up to, would love to be a part of the celebration. Get your favorite and least favorite quotes featured on the podcast, submit questions for our special guests, and find lots more new features and surprises at patreon.com/selfhelpless. You'll also get added to our Patreon Insider email list to easily redeem rewards via a quick email reply. Because we know hanging out on Patreon isn't everyone's thing. You can also opt out of emails if you prefer to be a silent supporter of the show. And don't worry, we do not Scrooge McDuck these contributions. 100% of proceeds go directly to operating expenses that make this weekly podcast possible and available to all. Learn more at patreon.com/selfhelpless or simply click the link in this episode's description. Thank you for helping me fill the void of being the last standing host of the Self-Helpless podcast. Thank you so much.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I'm no good at taking good advice, and I'm self-careless, so don't tell me twice that lately I've been so stuck in my head that I forget just about everything my therapist said. Maybe I'm self-helpless. Maybe I'm self-helpless. Maybe I'm self-helpless. Maybe we are all self-helpless.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Self-Helpless podcast. I'm Delaney Fisher, and today's episode is just, you know, one of the most impactful conversations I've ever been a part of. No big deal. I have two remarkable guests here, Sola Mahfouz and Malena Kapoor. Sola was born in Afghanistan and found refuge in the United States in 2016 to attend college. And at 11 years old, a group of men came to her door and threatened her and her family that if Sola didn't stop going to school, didn't stop getting an education, they would throw acid in her face or worse. There were several threats made. And, you know, they basically told her that her place was in the home and her purpose was to serve her future husband that she would be arranged with. And this was all at the same time that the Taliban had taken over. So after this, Sola decided to start self-educating behind closed doors. So she would stay up late at night teaching herself how to read and speak English, how to do math, worked her way up to things like physics and all kinds of subjects that people like me need tutors for. She knew she wanted to leave Afghanistan for a different life and, you know, for education. But there were so many obstacles in her way. She was able to take the SATs, which is a whole story behind that even, because she had to sneak off to do it. So you'll hear about that as well. And just, you know, as soon as she would take a step forward, a bunch of obstacles would show up that she had to overcome. And she eventually made it to the United States with the help of a friend. But other than that, you know, she was alone. She had to come here without any family. So cut to today, she is now a quantum computing researcher at Tufts University Quantum Information Group. So that's a bit of Sola's background. Malena is a student at Stanford, founder of Women in National Security. She served as a Defense Innovation Scholar at the Gordian Knot Center and as a Free Expression Fellow at PEN America, was on the management team of PRERNA, and was the producer of In Deep, a nationally syndicated public affairs radio program. So Sola and Malena met during the pandemic via Zoom. They've since developed a beautiful friendship and decided to co-author a book together. The book is called Defiant Dreams, The Journey of an Afghan Girl Who Risked Everything for Education. And I was just on the edge of my seat for this entire conversation. A lot of full body chills, holding back tears in a lot of moments. And when we were done recording, I had just sweat through all of my clothes. So listen, if you need an instant perspective shift today, if you want to feel immense gratitude for things that you've likely been taking for granted, if you need a fire lit in you, you know, maybe you've been coming up against some obstacles and you feel defeated, you're discouraged, you want to give up on something. Maybe you just need a reminder about how acts of kindness make an enormous difference in people's lives and in the world. Please tune into this entire episode because it will give you all of that. I got to record with Sola and Milena on the first day of Women's History Month, and that was really cool. It wasn't a planned thing, but we noticed that when we hit record. And you will not only learn about Sola and Milena's backgrounds and stories and how they've connected during this episode, but I really wanted to know, what was it that made Sola say to herself, no, I'm not going to stop getting an education? Like, what kept her going in the face of this enormous threat, this very real threat, and in the face of fear throughout every obstacle she had to navigate? What was she feeling inside herself? What was she saying to herself? Like, what was she thinking about? How did she think or know that any of this was possible? And how they've kept their sense of humor, joy, how they have fun through all of this. It was just, I just feel incredibly lucky to have been able to chat with them. So here is my conversation with Sola Mahfouz and Milena Kapoor. Sola and Milena, first of all, I am beyond honored to be having a conversation with you both. So thank you for being here today. And it's the start of Women's History Month right now. How cool. So yeah, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having us.
Yes. So Sola, can we start with your backstory? And then Milena, you know, what led to your partnership together as well?
Sure.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, Defiant Dream at the core of it, it's my journey of getting an education. And so, you know, when I was 16 years old, I did not even know how to add and subtract. And that's because when I was 11 years old, I was forced to stop going to school. A group of men came to our door and threatened us if we continued going to school. And since then, I left home only a couple of times a year. And whenever I did, I had to wear a suffocating burqa that covered me from head to toe. And meanwhile, my brothers were going to school and they were thriving academically. And over the years, I felt jealous of their life, that they had this purpose. But my life, meanwhile, was just dance around to what was happening, like socially. And there was no path that I was looking forward to. And so I started teaching myself, English. I was 14 years old. And then at 16, I began to learn math and science, all in the secrecy of my home. And then eventually, like in 2 years from not knowing how to add and subtract, because I was so obsessed with learning that I was able to study like college level calculus and physics. And eventually after many, many years, like every step that I took forward, there was this sea of problems that emerged, and I was able to go through it and eventually came to the US in 2016. And now I'm a quantum physics researcher at Tufts University. Wow. And so that's at the core, that's the story of my memoir, Defiant Dreams.
Oh my God, I have so many questions. But before we get into everything, Milena, how did you all meet and work together?
Yeah, so Sola and I first met now almost 3 years ago in the middle of COVID. And I think what drew us together initially was the fact that we were both so invested in the issues of around women's rights and amplifying these kinds of stories like Sola's that don't get told. Because I think the real beauty of Defiant Dreams is that yes, it's Sola's story and it's her life, but it's also now the story of millions of girls in Afghanistan who are being denied an education, and millions of girls before who have had to fight for their rights and you know, experienced violence and segregation and so many obstacles. And so we were both really united in wanting to share that story, And I think that's what brought us together. And then personally, I think also we have very similar cultures, and we were able to relate in, I think, a very unique way, a lot of unspoken connections. And so Sola started telling me stories from her life, and I started writing them, and that became the basis of this book.
Wow, it's amazing. Okay, so can we go back to that moment, Sola, that these men knocked on your door? And what was that like? What was said? How did this impact the whole family? Anything that you're able to share?
Sure. So I was in my own room, and I didn't hear, but then my father told us that, because this was the time in 2006 and 2007, the Taliban were, as I have to say, it's in Kandahar, my hometown, and Taliban were making its presence back. You know, there were suicide bombing exploding, and they were also threatening girls who were going to school. And so this was at that time. And that's, and you know, I was initially, when I stopped going to school, I was happy because I hated school. And but me and my mother, who was educated in the time in Afghanistan, was very different. She was like, I felt her pain in her eyes when she said that, do you know how it feels for an educated mother to see her kids grown up uneducated? You know, my older siblings' education was disrupted by the civil war and the Taliban, after Taliban rule in the 90s. But then this generation, after the 2001, when the US invaded and the schools were reopened, my mom had so much hopes for us that this generation of her kids are going to grow up differently. But unfortunately for the girls, that was disrupted very immediately. And so for me, it took me years to understand the gravity of that moment.
Wow. And what would have happened if you had gotten caught? Like the threat that they gave, what was it?
So if like they had like acid thrown on their face, on our faces, and like kidnapping or whatever. So things like that. And it's not just were empty threats. There were girls that there were like acids were thrown on their faces, and you know, fathers who defied those threats were like kidnapped, and even teachers were killed. So it was not just empty threats that one can defy it. It has taken seriously.
My gosh.
Yeah, I think something so important to understand is this is also happening at the time that the U.S. has a strong presence in Afghanistan. And as an American, I think growing up, I had this perception that the United States had come in, liberated the country, and there was this modernity kind of taking hold. But what's important to understand is that Sola grew up in the south of the country, in this city called Kandahar, which was a stronghold for the Taliban even back in the 90s and is now today. And so there was this, you know, strong culture of something more, you know, than just conservatism. Really, the oppression of women was something that was baked into life in that region, and it's something that never fully went away, and of course is now back at a much stronger level today.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I think like reading back history, it's like the Taliban actually created this when they were back in the insurgency. They actually created this organization or something to disrupt education, particularly for girls. So it wasn't just a culture, it's, I think, their insurgency enforcing so that they can win the war.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
So knowing the risks, right, and knowing these threats and how real they were, what made you want to continue to self-educate? Like, what was going on inside of you? What were you thinking? What were you saying to yourself?
Yeah, so I think when I was 14, I began to question, like, what's, like, the meaning of life, my life? What's, you know, why do I exist? Like, and then you know, I was seeing my brothers, they were going to school, and I couldn't see the difference. Like, why can't I do the same thing that they do? And the logic that the girls can't do it, something that, like, it failed to convince me that I can't do. And so I think it was really a lot of questions in my head. And I tried to, first of all, like, try to find answer in religion, and that I couldn't, like, initially find, like, obsessed with fashion, and then, like, went to religion, and then eventually I came to start educating myself, because I was lucky in a family to be born in a family that were educated. And, you know, my grandfather before me was self-educated, and he used to say that if you know English, it's like opening a window to the world. And at 14, I felt like the whole world around me was dark, you know, just like the political world, like what was happening politically. And also, like, yeah, what's happening, you know, like a person who was, you know, it's a transition from a young person, like, you know, transition to adulthood. And so I think this all things just came together, and that, like, propelled me to study.
I remember when we were writing this section of the book where Sola decides to start learning English and start educating herself, I used to write a few lines and then I would call her over and over, because I just couldn't understand how you can have a level of motivation where you go from knowing 4 or 5 words of English to being able to understand an entire news broadcast or read an entire newspaper, or know barely how to add and subtract and learn, you know, go to calculus in just a few years. That's just a remarkable transformation. And it was hard to, I think, articulate in the book initially. But I think what I realized is there's a level of, you know, when we learn in the United States or in the West, that promises us some level of progress. But when you're living as a woman where you've been denied the right to move around freely, you can't work, you can't exist outside the home, that education becomes a way to define yourself and to define the rest of your life. And I think that's something so unbelievably powerful that it's really difficult to understand unless you really immerse yourself in a story like Sola's. And then I think we also have to remember, it's, you know, a modern age, there is internet connection in Afghanistan, but it's still so dramatically different from what we experience here. When Sola started learning math and English and other subjects on a website called Khan Academy, which is an online learning platform that's here in the US too, you know, she had to access the internet in the middle of the night when everyone else was asleep, because during the day she was required to cook and clean for her family. And she used this incredibly slow dial-up internet connection. And this is in the late, you know, 2010s that she's still having to do this. And you know, just that level of restriction existed even to watch one video on addition or do one problem set on multiplication. And it's just incredible to think about how a person can even overcome those obstacles.
It's yeah, amazing. I mean, I have no words. Yeah, go ahead, Sola.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I said, like, it's like learning is good when it's available, but I think it becomes sacred when it's forbidden. So I think a lot of Afghans girls now, they share that feeling, like they say, it's like we're stealing lights from the God or something. Like, this is, you know, I think that, like, a lot of people don't understand, like, a lot, like how much hunger there is for learning in Afghanistan, especially if it's like restricted and forbidden.
That quote that you just said is a life-changing quote. Would you mind repeating it about what you said about education at the top?
Yeah. I said, it's good when you educate, it's good to have education, like, but when it's forbidden, it's become sacred.
Amazing. Melina, how has this impacted your life, meeting Sola, getting to know each other? You mentioned there's so many parallels and similarities, but also some huge differences in the background. So anything that you want to share about this experience on your end?
Sure. I mean, I think it's been a really transformative experience for me. Obviously, on one hand, I gained an incredible friendship. But also, I was writing this book as I was starting out as a college student at Stanford University. And so there was this real juxtaposition between me starting on this new chapter in my own education while really becoming immersed in the stories of so many girls and women who never had those opportunities. And then I think also what was incredibly powerful is that Sola and I met in 2020. And so we initially conceived of this book as ending with Sola's arrival in the United States. And, you know, that's where the story would end. But then, of course, in 2021, after the United States withdrew from Afghanistan and the Taliban took over, the book took on this new urgency. And I think living through that moment in history with an understanding not only of the history and culture that preceded it, but also the individual stories of Sola's mother, you know, who was once a professor and now is living through this new era again, or her grandmothers, or all her young nieces and nephews who are now still in Afghanistan. I think it was just an incredibly impactful experience.
Wow. So I have so many questions just around the logistics of how you educated yourself, Sola. So you mentioned looking up things, you know, in the middle of the night. So I'm assuming like nobody in your family knew, like you had to keep this a secret from everybody, or did anybody, was anybody aware what was going on?
Yeah, of course. I don't think I would have been able to educate myself without the support of my family. You know, yeah. They were aware of everything that I was doing. So, you know, it's like I was still, you know, a normal, like a tradition. I had, you know, a normal girl at home that I have to share responsibility with my sister and sister-in-law of like cleaning the house and, you know, cooking and everything. And, you know, Afghans are like huge family. And so there's a lot, you know, even as you're sharing it, there's still a lot to do it. And so, you know, initially I start with English. I started reading like newspapers that from my brother's my brothers that was learning like from it, and then I would watch TV like BBC or CNN, and like initially for hours and hours like I would watch and I would understand a word or two, and it was very, very difficult. But I was just, because of, you know, again, my grandfather said like, don't make an excuse. If you learn one word a day, it's like 365 words a year, so it's better than nothing. And so that's English. And like I remember one day I went to my brother's library, and I was like pick up this book, and then I like flipped through the pages and I couldn't understand a word in it. I could see the ABC and all of this, and then I felt like, will there be one day that I will be able to read this? And so, you know, it's like in Kandahar there wasn't a lot of like learning materials. All that was like newspapers or like watching like news, and I felt like there was already so much of horror and violence outside my house. And then I was also learning, so you know, one day my brother was going to Pakistan for medical reasons. I asked him like, just bring me anything in English that's not news. And so he brought me Time magazine, one of them. And so that's when I found out about Khan Academy. And when I went look at it, I was like, immediately felt like this is what I needed. So the first day when I opened Khan Academy, it's like the first page come was like the beauty of algebra. And I knew from the conversation of my brothers and cousins, like algebra is very hard. And I felt like, oh, this is not for me. Like, and so, but then like after a few days, curiosity took a better, I was so curious to understand what, like, maybe there's still something for me. I went to ask my brother, like what comes after an addition and subtraction? And he told me fractions. And so when I searched like Khan Academy, there was fractions. And then I also had to learn that, oh, I really, in my school, I didn't really learn my addition and subtractions, but I went back to study my addition and subtraction and followed fractions and everything.
Oh my gosh.
So that's, and I was obsessed. I just loved the structured of math. And, you know, it was, meanwhile, the social world was full of chaos, but there was this world of math that was, it was like step by step built. And I had to learn the first thing that, you know, each step I have to, there was this structure that I just felt that I needed.
Mm. It's so amazing that you had the support of your family. Did they have to protect you in certain ways, knowing that you were educating yourself, but obviously it wasn't allowed? There was a huge threat. Any kind of experiences around that where they had to, I don't know, cover for you or anything of that nature?
I mean, no one, like, no one because it was at my home, I was not leaving the house, so there wasn't, like, I was on my laptop, so anyone, you know, there wasn't this questions of what I was doing, you know. The guests came, I would be with them, sitting with them, socializing with them, but like on my own time I was doing my learning, so there wasn't a thing, like no one really knew what I was doing.
I think that question of what does support look like in that situation? We really grapple with that a lot in the book, especially thinking about the perspective of Sola's mother, who had been, and you know, she is an educated woman. She had gone to Kabul University. She had been a lecturer at Kabul University before the Civil War. And so in one sense, you know, she wanted this education and this gift of knowledge for her daughter. But on the other hand, she was living in a society where it's incredibly dangerous for a girl to be educated, not only because the act of educating yourself, you know, could gain attention from the Taliban or other forces, but also because the ideas that you start to learn about, you know, you do learn about these ideas of equality, or you do realize that there's no validity in the argument that a boy can learn something but a girl cannot. And those ideas are empowering in some contexts, but when you're living in Afghanistan, it's incredibly dangerous. So I think, you know, parents had to grapple with that tension often.
Right. Do you remember any kind of first, you know, I guess breakthroughs with your education where something, it just changed your perspective on anything? Do you remember like any first thing that you read that just changed your whole world?
I think it happened slowly, but one thing I feel like each time I learned something new, there was like more questions. It's just like, it's by the time you learn, you never feel like, oh, there's one time I did not know. Or so I think for me initially when I was able to read English, that was because I only knew like my brothers could, like only the guys, the men could do this. And so I think that, and also like, oh yeah, so like learning science, math was one day, you know, my father was like always like would quiz the kids that were still going to school on math. And so my father, there was like my cousins like visiting from Germany and everyone. And so he gave this questions of math, and I think it was not for my brothers, but like for other cousins, and some are visiting from Pakistan who are actually going to school, and some from Germany, and no one was able to solve it, but I was able to solve it because just like a week ago or something, I did that lesson on Khan Academy. And I think that was before that, because I was finding math easy on Khan Academy, and I just felt like maybe either it's not as hard as everyone is doing it, or how could I be like learning this so quickly? So I was like questioning Khan Academy. And then when I did that question, like when I solved it and I was the only one who was able to do it, I think this reinforced like, oh, you know, what I'm doing is correct. And it's, yeah. So I think that was one moment that I remember.
Amazing. Milena, anything to add to that?
Sure. I think this story is not in the book, but a story that really struck me that I think demonstrates how internalized this idea that men can learn but women cannot really, really can be, is that Sola told me the story of when she was starting to learn. You know, everyone told her girls aren't meant to learn, they aren't built to learn. And so one day she was studying and she got a migraine. And, you know, that happens to all of us. Right. You're staring at books too long or something, but she took that as a sign, like, oh, you know, women, maybe they actually get sick when they learn, maybe because this is the, you know, the environment of the stories that you grow up with. And I think that story really stuck with me because it indicates the fact that, yes, you have these men actively telling you, you know, or telling girls in Afghanistan, you can't do this or you can't do that. But there's also something psychological about it. And part of liberation is about breaking past those psychological traps as well.
Yeah, that's such a great point. So Sola, you had mentioned that you were only leaving the home like a couple times a year or something like that.
Yeah, so I mean, I think when you're leaving the house, you have to wear a burqa, and I hated it. And so And also, it's not safe for a woman alone to, like, for a young woman to kind of just like leave the house too.
Okay.
And so that was the reasoning. And then whenever I did have to leave, it's like to weddings or like, you know, in Eid, like the Muslim holiday, going to a relative's house. So those were the times that I would leave the house.
Okay.
With my family. Yeah.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And oh yeah, go ahead, Malena.
I was just gonna say, Sola, if you want to explain what that burqa is and what that feels.
Yes, please. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I have a very I don't want it. I don't. This is my relationship with burqa, and so I feel like whenever, like, it's like you're disconnected from yourself. You know, it's like when you wear this thing, you just become a nobody. You know, and I felt like whenever I had to wear it, I just felt like less of a human being, and I just hated that feeling, and so that's why, like, I didn't want to put myself in that situation.
Right. Malena, anything else to add?
I mean, I think also just the fact that the burqa is the most restrictive garment for women in the world. It completely covers every part of your body. Even your eyes are covered with this kind of crisscross mesh lining. One of the most powerful stories, I think, in the book is actually about the first time that Sola's mother wore a burqa, which was actually during the Civil War, when some of these really conservative forces were starting to come into Kandahar, and also when it was an incredibly violent time. And so she's wearing this this burqa for the first time, and her young son, who's Sola's brother, had never seen her dress like that. And so he's walking with her through the streets, but he was leading her as if she was blind. You know, he thought that she couldn't see. And, you know, of course she can see a little bit through those crisscross slats. And so the family laughed at him, like, this young boy doesn't understand how a burqa works. But I think if you reflect on it, his innocent assessment really was correct in many ways, that actually she had lost so much and she really had gone blind.
Wow. What steps led you to the United States, Sola? Like, what was that path like?
Yeah, so, you know, I was learning, you know, everything, you know, but then there's come a time that I realized, you know, I can't just sit in my room and like study forever. And so I had to find a way to get out and study abroad. And so I was, and I knew from my brother, like my brother went to England and he had to take this test, the IELTS test, which is an English test. And so I stopped preparing for that. And when I was preparing for that, I like registered myself on this online learning exchange program, which is like, you have to, like, I speak Pashto, so the other person can learn Pashto from me, and I want to learn, practice my English, so, you know, the other person, so it's like a language exchange program. And so there I met this girl living in the US, Emily. And so when I started talking to her, I told her like what I was doing, and she said, well, you should come to the US. And for that, and because I was self-taught, I had to take, like, there was no way for me to show that I know all of those things. So I had to take the SAT, and that was not available in Afghanistan. And so I had to, and before that, I also had tried, even before that, I had to try, if I can get a test in Afghanistan to get like a local, like equivalent of 12th grade. But, you know, they were not allowing me to do this because they said, well, you know, there are other girls who are going to school and they have to go to 12th grade, and we can't just give you, it's not right. And they were not even like looking at my eyes. And so that was like shattered. So then I have to take this international exams. And it was not available in Afghanistan. And so I convinced my uncle was going to Pakistan, and I convinced him that I would go with him. And so I went to Pakistan, one of the most dangerous border in the world. And,
Gosh.
So I went there, and when I learned that there was no IELTS, like no SAT exam spot. And so, but there was like many obstacles, and somehow I registered. I waited for 3 months and I took the SAT with an also IELTS exam, and I returned. and applied for colleges in the US, and I got accepted to some. And so the next step was now to get a visa to come to the US. And when I applied for like appointment to get the visa, and we flew with my mother, we flew to Kabul. And at the embassy, Kabul, the US embassy in Kabul, in just 1 minute, my visa was rejected. And the officer said, "Well, we don't think you're going to the US to study. You're just going there to immigrate." And I think this was the first time I realized how the world see Afghans. And I just felt like I was falling to this abyss of, I came so far, and this one person just in 1 minute decides for me, like, what's my next step in life?
Yeah,
I
Melena,
think
anything? That SAT story is really incredible. Just to give a few more details, the fact that first Sola tried to get some sort of certification from the Ministry of Education, but the fact that they wouldn't even look her in the eye because she was a woman, let alone give her the right paperwork. And then, as Sola said, when she realized that the only way she was going to be able to take the SAT was to take it in Pakistan, she had to cross what is one of the most dangerous borders in the world. This is the border where there are often beatings, where men and women have to cross separately, where you have to go through the crossing in multiple vehicles. And then she, gets to Pakistan and realizes that there's no spot left to take that SAT. And so somehow, and Emily and Sola and so many other people are trying to get in touch with the College Board and other organizations to try and get that spot. And then she has to go in and take that exam, having just endured all of that. And I think when we reflect on that story, those were the challenges that she had just to prove her education at a time when the United States was still present in Afghanistan. Now, think about how incredibly difficult it is for any Afghan girl who somehow manages to connect to the internet, somehow manages to learn math and English and science. Even then, the first step out of the country is almost impossible to achieve.
Yes. And so in that moment of crossing the border, what was that like for you? And what were the logistics around that? Like what you mentioned, maybe having to drive separately or walk separately, or what was that like?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I was thinking at that time was like, oh, I'm taking the test. So that was, even though it was difficult, I
Yeah.
was just focused on like, oh, what will happen after I take the test? So I was thinking about the other end of what's going to come out of this journey. And
Yeah.
so,
Yeah. Would you say that really focusing on why you were doing everything got you through a lot of the fear that I'd imagine you experienced through this whole process? Is there anything else that you would tell yourself or any phrases you would repeat to yourself that helped you in those moments?
yeah, I think for me, it was, that's like getting an education, learning, that was what gave meaning to my life. And I knew like I can't, like it was the purpose of my life. And I felt like if I, just like it's like the backbone of my life. And if I wanted to give up on it, and then I knew that I will not be able to live like, I would be just broken person. And so I really had to. And if it, I was like, I would ask myself, if I give up on this thing, what will I be able to stand for? And so that's what, like, I was like, no matter what the obstacle, I have to go through it.
Malena, anything that you want to share about that story or experience?
I mean, I remember Sola, we wrote in the book, there was a Bollywood quote that you often repeated to yourself, but what exactly? I'm sure you'll remember the quote exactly.
Yeah, I do. It said, so there was this one movie that I watched. It said, "I want to run, I want to fly. I don't care even if I fall. I just don't want to stop." And those were like the things that I would say, like, I don't care if I fall, but I want to keep going.
Oh, I love it. I love it. And so, was there any moment in time where you seriously considered giving up or giving in to this?
I think I knew that I'm not going to give up. I just felt the world is going to give up on me. And that's what I was scared of, you know, when my visa was rejected. I mean, no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't just tell this person, you know, even that minute he told that visa officer from the other side of the window told me that I can't get a visa. I asked why, like, I was like, my eyes were full of tears and I asked, why can't you give this to me? And he was just, yeah, because you're like, you don't want, because you're going to, you're an Afghan and you're just going to immigrate there, not to study. And I just felt like the ground was shifted from my feet. And I think that's when, like, Emily was there for me, like my friend Emily, who was mentoring me and like trying to create a path for me. And so I think no matter, and as an individual, no matter how strong one is, if there needs to be some outside support that gives hope that, okay, I should not give up. And this was at the time, if there was no outside support, I couldn't just go through, like, give me a passport, give me a visa. I wouldn't be able to do that.
Yeah. So how did you eventually get to the United States with all these obstacles popping up? Every time you take an action, it's like you were met with 10 different obstacles to get through. What ended up happening?
So, you know, Emily was connecting me to, like, she was at that time 24 years old, and she also had this view of the US, you know, helping Afghan and all of that. And when she experienced that obstacle with me, you know, here I am, I took did everything, and yet I am not able to get a visa. And so she was furious. And so she was like, oh, this is some, you know, it became her goal of life. And so she was contacting everyone, and somehow she got in touch with New York Times columnist, and he wrote about me, and that's what led me to get a visa and come to the US.
Wow. And did you come alone? Did any of your family come with you?
No, I was the only one, because even one person, it's so impossibly hard to get a visa alone, like a family or so. And it's important to note that I didn't get a student visa. I just got this one-way sticker that I was not able to travel back and see my family. And so it was a very hard, even though I got the visa, I did not know when I will be able to see my family, like what will unfold. And so, yeah, that's.
Oh my gosh. So you're arriving to America by yourself. Your family's not there with you. What's the first thing that you did when you arrived? What are those first few steps?
Yeah, so, you know, I came and my friend Emily was there for me. And so initially I was still, you know, I went to Kabul again for my visa. And so initially it just, at that time in Kabul was extremely, there was a lot of violence, of suicide bomb exploding. And so when I came, the initial, Chicago airport, and then on the road, there was this peace and calmness. And I just felt like, I couldn't feel it was real. Whenever we would go into traffic, I just, for a few weeks that I would feel like, oh, maybe a suicide bomb is going to explode. Like, there was fear in me that this, but of course it was also like, I was able to bike, you know, the first day, Emily and his father, like her father, like brought this bike, and I was biking, and I loved biking when I was back in Kandahar, and I always biked inside my compound, which is like, with each like few seconds I have to turn. And this suddenly that this road ahead of me was stretched like for miles and miles, and I could just bike, and it felt really great.
Yeah, there's one story we tell in the book about the moment that Sola landed in the United States, and then her friend Emily came to pick her up, and so they meet at the airport and they're about to get in the car to drive away, and Sola just stops for a minute because Emily gets behind the wheel and she's never seen a woman drive a car before.
Wow. Yes.
And then she gets into the passenger seat, and as a woman, she's never been able to sit in the front.
and see the view, and you know she's not covered or nothing is obstructed. And I think those are the small things we don't even think about.
Exactly. Oh my gosh, I've just had chills this entire conversation. I'm sweating. I'm like on the edge of my seat listening to every step that you've taken to be here. So okay, so you make it to the US, and were you able to see your family? Have you been able to see your family since being here?
Recently, I've been able to, just in the past couple of months, because my visa, wow. For 7 years, I didn't have anything. So I was just stuck here.
Wow. So, okay. So Emily picks you up at the airport. And then what happens after that, you know, getting into school and all of that?
Yeah, so I got a scholarship at Arizona State University. And so in October 2016, I came to Arizona State University, and I started studying math and physics. And, you know, I went to then start research just a year after. I started research in quantum gravity, and because I had all of those questions from, you know, back from when I was 14 of how the world works, you know, and those questions made me, you know, pushed me to study philosophy and physics and go back to like the origins of everything. And so when I came to the like Arizona State University, and there are people researching actually all of those. And so, yeah, and I just felt like there's two lives in some sense, you know, these are the things that I was like reading it in a book, and suddenly here I am, like I can calculate things, you know, I can calculate the years from Big Bang to now, and like the way the universe expanded and everything. And so, yeah, I think that was, yeah, I think learning this, the intellectual part of, yeah, it's still sometimes when I still do things, I feel like, oh, am I really that person who once like was in her room and like was kind of dreaming of it one day? I couldn't even dream about that, those things then. And right now I can talk to people about it, and I'm actually researching all of that. So I think it felt really surreal. And it still does when I think about the two separate lives of the person who was in Kandahar in the kitchen thinking about those things and the person who I am now.
Unbelievable.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
I mean, when you first got here, was there certain things that you just couldn't get enough of? Like you mentioned, like you started riding your bike, or just, you know, seeing a woman drive a car. Were there things that I would imagine it was kind of overwhelming? Anything that you want to share about those things that you really enjoyed, especially in the beginning of getting here?
Yeah, I think swimming, like Arizona State University had this big swimming pool, like initially when I went there. And again, like I also loved swimming when I was young, when I was a young kid. But then I had to stop that. And so I just felt like my 11-year-old self again. And so for the first, in the first semester, I almost went to the swimming pool every day. And I just felt like, I don't know, it was like a pause of like the part, you know, the years that I was kind of had to stop everything. It just felt like there was this pause between the 11-year-old me, the 11-year-old self, and now the 20-year-old self that was in the US. And it just felt that this 20-year-old self was getting connected back to the 11-year-old self. So that's how I felt.
Yeah, I think when I first met Sola, I was really struck by you know, the joy she was finding in those things that she had done as a child and I had done as a child. And I think her story really brings home the tragedy of the fact that there are young girls in Afghanistan who are given this taste. You know, they're taken to the river a few times to go swimming, or they get to go out
to the bazaar for a few years with their brothers. And so they know what freedom can feel like, and they taste that for just a few years. And then at such a young age, an age like 11, all of that is taken away for the rest of your life. And suddenly your life becomes just confined by these four walls. But you know what it could
look like,
what life looks like outside, and what boys and then men, you know, have access to every single day. And so it's just the tragedy of a childhood cut short, I think.
Yeah. And I think it's also important that also tells you, you know, when you see a woman in a burqa, it feels like so different than us or people here. Yeah. But, you know, behind the burqa, she's just like person here.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that's a theme we try to bring through in the book, too. We often talked about this idea that we want to reject notions of passivity or victimhood, and to try, so often in the news, you know, Afghan women and girls are portrayed as these kind of faceless, nameless victims. And we wanted to show the capacity for laughter and joy and dancing, but the fact that all of that is happening in such a confined space and under a life of such profound restriction. But there's so much potential for that to exist without the restriction.
Sola, was it challenging for you, like coming to the States, like going to Arizona University, and just maybe just being around people that took a lot of this for granted? Like you mentioned, like swimming in that pool, right? And how it probably meant something completely different to you than maybe the other people at that pool. I can't imagine how that must feel. I don't know. Anything that you want to share about that experience?
I think for me, one was, for me, as I said, like for me, learning was sacred and still is. Like one thing was how in colleges, how people are just complaining, like they have to study for exam. And I felt like there was, like learning was reduced to something. That was one thing shocking for me.
Yeah.
There wasn't this love for learning. Like, okay, I have to, like, that's how I felt, you know, when I was in Afghanistan. And I just felt like when I come to colleges, you know, I would read like books by Plato and the ancient Greeks, and like everyone is engaged in this conversation, what is life and all of that. And so I felt like, oh, when that's how the environment in the university is going to be too. But that's what I didn't find. But I did find like the professors who were like that, but overall it wasn't that kind of environment. And the second thing I felt like it was when I moved to Massachusetts, to Boston, was this, you know, people complaining, like there's the story in the book as well. You know, I went to a restaurant and then this person was giving his order, and, you know, it was a family run restaurant. And, you know, the person's owner said, well, it's going to take 45 minutes. And this person just like shouted, oh, like it sucks. Like, how can you give me this? Like this in 45 minutes. And meanwhile, at the time I was talking to my family, and then it just like, oh, my father would say, oh, I was walking, there was a person got shot, or like, you know, there was bombing exploding and everything. So I felt like how, you know, people people try to, you know, kind of make it light, the situation lighter. And so I felt like in Afghanistan, people were complaining less than people here. So and even though like life is, it's such a perfect, like even that day I went out and I was looking at it like, oh, such a beautiful weather. There's the calmness of the street. So the way I was seeing everything and the way that person was seeing it was such a different, and it was because I'm from a different place and he is from the different. So that's oftentimes I think about, sometimes I go out with my friend on a bike and he says, oh, there's like traffic. And then I'm looking at, oh, I can bike. And so I think a lot of those kind of things.
I can't even imagine like experiencing like that juxtaposition of like, I don't know, one of your college students like complaining about Instagram not working or something. And you're like, you have no idea, you know, what I've seen and what I've been through.
Yeah, I mean, I think I also can't imagine it because I felt it. Having worked on the book for a year and then starting as a freshman in college, I felt like I was living in two different worlds where, you know, on one hand, we'd be, you know, video calling late into the night and trying to figure out how do we convey what this violence really feels like, or how do we convey what this restriction feels like? And on the other hand, you do feel like you're living in just a totally different world with different problems. And it also helped me to realize the fact that I'd always cared about issues like women's rights, but I realized diving into the issue of Afghanistan that it is so easy for us to turn away from these stories. And people do care, but they care while it's a headline on the New York Times, or they care while they flip on the TV and they see a segment on it, or it's on their social media feed. But it's so easy to move on. And the reality of this book, which is Sola's story, but honestly stretches decades, proves that you know, it's not over in a second or in a news cycle for the people who are actually living it. So grappling with that, I think even personally for me, was really difficult.
Right. Did it make it hard to enjoy things that your peers were enjoying? Like, you know, going through all this, working on the book together. How did you infuse joy and fun into this experience?
I think I feel like Afghans have a very dark sense of humor. So
I love it.
So even though you know, like the funniest story comes, you know, when people are hiding from rockets, or so even like if you listen to an Afghan, they're gonna be like telling you one of the saddest story, but that person is gonna be laughing at you, and like so I think it's even though it's serious everything, we do find ways to find joy in life in our own way.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Melina, anything that you want to add to that? Like, you know, humorous moments from working together or the book or anything like that?
I mean, I think one of the great gifts of this process has been that we formed a really close friendship. And I think also that's because, you know, Sola was telling me everything about her life, and that can't happen in a vacuum. In order to have that relationship, you know, I also have to share about my life and my dreams, and then she shares about hers, and we don't just talk about what's in the book, you know, we talk about our lives. And so the joy was really in getting to know each other, and especially at a time when the rest of the world was shut down. And so I think also because there is something exciting about thinking about how you want to share a story like this with the rest of the world, and how do you want to do it differently than journalists or other authors who have come before. Yeah. That is an energizing process. Of course, there are devastating moments in the book, but we wanted it to be a story that ultimately also serves as a kind of call to action. And so, you know, that was also inherent in the process.
Yeah.
And also like to change the narrative. I mean, I think even now that I read story, I'm like, well, this is so incomplete. Like, why is, you know, it reduces the complexity. And this one in the Defiant Dreams, we really wanted to, as much as we could, is to like give this whole picture of the political, of the personal, and the cultural and everything.
Yeah. So thrilled about your book. It's called Defiant Dreams. What are a few main takeaways from the book that you really want people to carry with them for the rest of their lives?
I think one of the most powerful themes in the book is this idea of mothers and daughters. Mm-hmm. And the fact that in Afghanistan, so many mothers have experienced more freedoms than their daughters ever will. And of course, now that's even more true with the recent Taliban takeover. So I think thinking about history moving backwards and what that's like and what our responsibility is to continue to shine a light on that, on what's happening and how that's happening, I think that's one major theme of the book. I would also say, I think we read statistics and we read numbers, and it's important to think about the fact that there are millions of Solas out there, and any emotion that someone might feel reading the book, because I think it is a deeply emotional book, you know, imagine that multiplied by 2.5 million. And just to say, you know, what the situation is like in Afghanistan right now, there have been over 75 Taliban edicts since 2021 that are targeted specifically against women. So this means everything from the sweeping bans on education or women entering the workforce, but it also means that last week, the Taliban banned women from calling in and sharing their stories on TV or on radio. Or over the summer, the Taliban banned beauty salons, which might seem like something frivolous, but when you don't have a job and you don't have school and you don't leave the house, that beauty salon can become the last marker of your identity. And it's also a place that employed so many women. There's a mental health crisis in Afghanistan right now, where there's been a massive surge in suicides and suicide attempts by women since the Taliban takeover. And now it's estimated that 80% of all suicide attempts in Afghanistan are by women. And that's unique, because the phenomenon in the world is usually that, you know, men tend to, the suicide rates for men tend to be higher than for women. So I think the main takeaway I hope people have from the book is that Sola's story is one of many, and that even though you may not see Afghanistan in the news as much as you did 2 years ago, there's really never been a greater urgency in sharing these stories.
Yeah,
and I think for me also to add to that is also Afghans are mostly seen, Afghan men and women generally are seen as like either violent extremists or hopeless victims. But we are beyond that. And, you know, we love humor, we love basic things in life. And Afghanistan exists as long as human civilization, and it can't be reduced to those two things. And I think that's the only thing you hear about the people is either they're victims or violent extremists, then it's hard to empathize with their suffering. Mm-hmm. And so one of the reasons is this Defiant Dreams is it's personal, so that it brings like each individual experience to your heart. And so that when you see it on TV, this broad generalization, people people are able to reject this, because they have seen something more beyond that. So that's one of the reasons I really wanted to share my story and the stories of Afghanistan through Defiant Dreams.
Yeah. And I can't even imagine like how many people are tuning in right now. They're super inspired by you both. They want to help. They want to make a difference, but this issue just feels so massive beyond anything that they can do to help. And maybe they feel a little bit powerless, like, oh, one person can't make a difference. So what can we do to support these efforts?
Yeah, I think this is a question we've grappled with, especially because as we go around the country and give book talks, that's the question we get. And it's a hard one to answer, because on one hand, as Sola has mentioned, there are obstacles around visas and things that maybe we feel like only world leaders can actually do to change. My perspective is, and this is something we've talked a lot about, is the primary thing that everyday people can do is to continue to talk about this. I mean, their UN Women has designated this gender apartheid, spokespeople from UN Women. So this is a massive human rights issue, and we've seen the world, you know, galvanized and gathered around these massive kind of rights abuses before. So that's one thing. In terms of tangible solutions that people can work on, something we've talked a lot about is the idea that, you know, how can we harness the power of the internet and help those girls who at least do have connections to the internet? And right now there are online learning platforms that do exist, but a lot of those platforms don't take into account the specific needs of Afghan women, both in terms of culture and being able to share their stories and connect with one another, but also simple things like, can they download a video if they're using dial-up internet? You know, is it accessible? And so we've been thinking about the real need for, and I think about this coming from Silicon Valley, the real need for entrepreneurs and business leaders and tech companies to step up and really fill this void.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And another thing is we're starting, I think we've already started this hashtag, My Defiant Dreams, on Twitter, and also be launching it on Instagram, so that everyone posts to support Afghan women's, is like to support their defiant dreams and how, you know, the world should support like Afghan women. And so that would also be a way to show the Afghan women that they are not alone.
Amazing, amazing. I mean, what you're both up to currently is incredibly impressive. Can each of you share what your current day-to-day life is like with school and things that you're working on, all of that?
So I'm a researcher at Tufts, but I'm also really, really interested now in like writing like a more fiction about Afghanistan. And I'm really going back to the origins, back into like being an Afghan, what it means to being a Pashtun, and you know, how the identity changes when, you know, outside forces comes to your country. So that's mostly, I'm really like involved in Afghanistan, not just in the present time, but also like going back to the past and trying to understand the present from knowing the past more deeply.
Mm. Yeah, for me, I'm a junior right now at Stanford, so still an undergrad. And I'm really interested in thinking about what are the government level changes that can be made to solve these kinds of problems. So I'm really passionate about getting involved in foreign policy. And I'm also starting research right now on a senior thesis that explores the issue of veiling and unveiling in the Middle East, and how laws and decrees around women's clothing and women's bodies have been used to capitalize on state control in the region.
Incredible. I'm really curious, just for, you know, personally, how do each of you take care of yourself? I mean, you're working on such big things. What do you do for fun? What do you do for self-care? How do you escape when you need an escape? Yeah, whoever wants to start.
So I love biking, and I still do bike a lot. I also love reading fiction. So I'm currently reading War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy.
Oh, nice.
And also friends, you know, hanging out with friends and family, talking to family. And awesome. I think young people are also very, very, they're really talking to young people are so, I think they haven't seen the horribleness of the world. So I think mm-hmm. the innocence, like just spending some time with them and trying to see the world through a more innocent way is also something that's I like to do.
That's nice. That's really nice. Melina?
I think for me, I would agree, friends and family. I'm lucky to go to school close by to my parents and my younger brother. I also love music. I'm also an opera singer.
Very cool.
That's a great way to unwind.
Amazing. You know, I imagine you both are so many people's inspiration, or you're about to be, especially with your new book. Is there anybody in particular who has made an impact on you or has inspired you? I'm sure each other as well, but anybody in particular that you draw inspiration from?
For me, it's my grandfather. He was self-educated, and it's because of him I knew that there is a path to be educated, and not just be educated. You know, he was a writer, he was a philosopher, he was a poet. So oftentimes I think, even though he has been, I mean, I have never seen him, met him, but I think he continues to be my inspiration.
I love that.
I think family is a big part of it for me too. I think now about why I care so much about these issues of education and women's rights. And I think it really comes down to my family story. And I even told Sola, you know, sometimes the stories she would share sounded like they were coming from my grandparents' generation in India. And my grandparents and my dad made so many sacrifices to come to the United States and to pursue their educations and their careers. And I feel like that gift has now finally come to me and my brother, to be able to have the freedom to study what we want and the freedom to do what we want in the world because of those sacrifices, which I think just makes me reflect a lot on and care a lot about the issues that Sola and I have been working on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What has there been any kind of challenges that you have faced now that, you know, you've written the book is out, you're speaking to people? What kind of obstacles are you now currently navigating, you know, together or individually, or any like criticisms as well that you have to navigate?
I would say that, you know, writing the book for us, it was very important to focus on the nuance of the storytelling and to really, there were some things I think because of our similar cultures that we just understood intuitively. And then we thought really hard, you know, how do you actually explain what an arranged marriage is and why is that right. different from what someone who's only spent time in the United States might initially think it is? And how do you explain what it's like, you know, to move as a new wife into your mother-in-law's home and when you're not allowed to work and you're not allowed to leave the home, like those kinds of really specific experiences. And I then of course the nature of the media is that how do you get that down into a 5-minute soundbite? And so I think it's been really important for us to think about how to preserve that nuance and preserve the color of the stories that we're trying to tell. Even as we try to share this book and Sola's story as widely as we can.
Beautifully put. Yep, makes a lot of sense. Sola, how about for you?
I don't think I have anything more to add other than what Milena said.
This is another question just for me that I'm curious about for both of you. As I've gotten deeper into my own activism, I find myself feeling just really sad a lot more than usual. And I want to know, how do you kind of use the injustice that's going on in the world as fuel and motivation to keep going versus kind of allowing yourself to kind of fall into a darker spiral? Because I'm definitely struggling with that quite a bit.
Yeah, for me, it's a lot of this understanding. Like I think I'm a very emotional person, and everything I've done in my life, it's a reaction to something, and it continues. Like you know, and so it's again today. There's so much happening in the world, and then I try to go, why is it like that? You know, what's and so I try to reason, like kind of try to understand everything around it, and then form my own opinions of it. Well, you know, it's like maybe in your heart you know how it feels, but how do you communicate this to other person? Maybe it's very obvious, but yet people don't see it. So I think for me it's really to educate myself around it. So be well informed. So when I'm telling someone, I'm coming from, you know, a position of, so that's how I am. Like I go deeper into it. Yes, I think for 3 or 4 days I'm really sad about it. Then I come out of it. Okay, I have to understand this, why this thing is, and then I think that's how everything that I do. That's how it is.
Yeah.
I think for me, it again comes down to the personal story. I think what to me is very overwhelming. Is when you read, you know, thousands of people killed, or you just read these very impersonal descriptions of massive problems. But I think my process is to first understand the facts and the figures and what's going on, and then to go into personal stories and try to understand the intricacies of what's actually happening and what people are living through. Because I think when I'm able to relate to someone or see a connection between myself and someone else who's experiencing this tragedy or this geopolitical situation, then it's easier to turn that into fuel to try and move towards action. Hmm.
Thank you for sharing that. This is good words of wisdom for me to keep in mind. Thank you so much for this conversation and for giving us your time. Where can people learn more about both of you, get the book, support women's education? What would you like to plug here?
I think you can find Defiant Dreams in bookstores or online anywhere. And then I'm at Milena Kapoor on Twitter and Milena Kapoor on Instagram. And Sola?
Yeah, I'm at Milena. Sorry. That's Sola, my first one. With some numbers on Twitter. I think if you just search Sola Mahfouz, it will come. And same on Instagram, Sola at Sola Mahfouz. And yes, the book is available on Amazon and other stores. And you can also have the Defiant Dreams page to get more information.
Amazing. Awesome. Well, thank you both so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much to Sola and Milena for doing the podcast, for sharing this message, for all the courage, the resilience, just everything. Like, isn't it hard to even fathom? I failed algebra and had the support that I needed. Meanwhile, Sola's teaching herself like quantum physics in her bedroom with dial-up internet. What? It's all just so incredibly inspiring. I love how they mentioned that dark humor really gets them through a lot of stuff. That just gave me a sense of relief or permission, I guess, because dark jokes, dark humor are pretty much how I get through life, all of my life. And sometimes I have felt very bad about that part of myself because I know that's not how everybody copes. And hearing Sola share that it's really a staple for her made me feel like, okay, cool. I'm allowed to laugh through all the challenging stuff. So please go get this book, Defiant Dreams. Share about it with your family, friends, community. Post about it on social media. If you work in the media, if you have a podcast, book them. Let's all get the word out. And once we stopped recording, we were laughing like, okay, how great will it be when you're on the cover of Time Magazine? What a full circle moment that will be, since that was one of the first publications Sola mentioned that she got her hands on to read. So Time Magazine, if you're listening, okay, let's make this happen. Sola and Milena also mentioned that they've launched the hashtag My Defiant Dream, where they're encouraging others to share their dreams and stories. So feel free to do that as well. And before we wrap up, we do have a quick iTunes review of the episode, or Apple Podcast review. This is from Mindy Wesley. It says, love this podcast. This podcast is keeping me sane. Keep up the amazing work. XOXO. Mindy, thank you so much. I really appreciate this. You know what? Like, this podcast keeps me sane too. As somebody who has done a lot of different things throughout my career, this is the thing that I have done for the longest amount of time that I've been the most consistent with. And I have found that it really grounds me. I learned so much from our guests. I've learned so much about myself through doing it. And I just love having these conversations. So I feel the same way you do. And I'm really glad that you took the time to share that. So thank you so much. Feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, formerly iTunes, and I'll read it on the next episode. I'll get a chance to say hi to you directly. So glad that you are here, that you tuned in today, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye. Maybe I'm self. Thank you for tuning in to the Self Helpless Podcast. You can find our Patreon community, merch, and other goodies at selfhelplesspodcast.com. We'd be thrilled if you left an iTunes review, shared this episode with a friend, or post about it on Instagram and tag at Self Helpless Podcast so we can repost you and say hi. Thanks, everyone.